tonight, I want to talk about Case 41 from the Gateless Barrier. Bodhidharma pacifies the mind. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow, cut off his arm, and said, "Your disciple's mind has no peace. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest for me." Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind, and I will put it to rest for you." The second ancestor said, "I have searched exhaustively for my mind, heart and soul, and I cannot find it." Bodhidharma said, "There, I have put it to rest for you." Bodhidharma is this guy on the scroll by the timekeeper. He is regarded as the first ancestor of Zen Buddhism. He brought what would become Zen from India, where he was a monk, to China. Bodhidharma is often called the old barbarian, because this is how Chinese regarded foreigners. Sometimes the red-bearded barbarian. He is often depicted as kind of gruff and angry looking, but I like this sweet grandfatherly rendering that we have in our Zendo. Bodhidharma's practice of facing the wall was so vivid, so earnestly practiced by him, that the legend says that the tea trees came into being because they grew where Bodhidharma threw down his own eyelids so that he could never fall asleep. A great story for the origin and effect of caffeine. Bodhidharma, there was already Buddhism in China, had been for centuries when Bodhidharma got there, but it was of two varieties, mainly esoteric Buddhism, which is sometimes called in other traditions, Tantric Buddhism. It became Tendai Buddhism or Shingon Buddhism. And the variety of Buddhism that Bodhidharma had encountered in India. India was known for its great monastic universities, thousands of monks studying in essentially doctoral programs, details of Buddhist philosophy. The Indian Mahayana treatises, you know, they are almost mathematical in precision, and they have sections that are frequently numbered 4.7.3.2, subsection 1a. And so on, bring order to the precise amount of philosophical investigation that they contain. And this is a style of practice that lives on in what's called analytical meditation, or exploring philosophical ideas, and really carefully investigating the truth, the reality of all the things we assume to be true, with great precision. Bodhidharma didn't much like this style of practice. I like to imagine that it seemed to him, as it seems to me, kind of a lot of work, kind of a hard way to do things. For me, even from the very beginning of my Zen practice, part of what drew me to live in the Zen monastery after, which is what I did immediately after college for a year and a half, and I had studied intensively cognitive science, the philosophy and neuroscience and computational science of consciousness, but part of and language and other things. But part of what drew me to Zen was a sense that somehow it shouldn't be as hard as all that. Like somehow I had a sense that something about really living directly in alignment with what is had to be easy, had to be in some sense not so hard. And it wasn't in any sense not hard for me. It was excruciatingly difficult, and many of you have heard me tell the story of when I decided to bail on the prospect of grad school and go into a Zen monastery when I was standing out there looking at a lake on my campus, being in this place of great angst and great distress, recovering from a brain injury, struggling with my work, struggling with my relationships. And I was looking out at these ducks on the lake. And these ducks were just being ducks. And it was so clear to me that there was a thing that was like the ducks' practice of just being ducks, which came so naturally to them, seemed to me, as far as I could tell, that was the equivalent way for me to be me. But I had no idea what this was. And it was excruciatingly difficult for me to be me. And so I kind of resolved to get to the bottom of this, because I knew, I knew on some level that there was a way for me to just meet my life from a place of freedom and spaciousness, at least more than I seemed to be able to at that time. I had enough exposure to Buddhism and Zen that I had a sense that Zen might be part of the way to do that. And so leaving the academic world for the Zen world, kind of like a version of Bodhidharma's leaving the monastic universities to come to China and, in fact, sit in a cave. Bodhidharma, his teachings are distilled down, he distilled them down to four statements, which are what is written there in Chinese on the scroll. They are a special transmission outside sutras, no dependence on words or phrases, directly pointing to the human mind, seeing into one's nature and attaining Buddhahood. A special transmission outside sutras, no dependence on words and letters, throwing aside all not containable in the voluminous study of the texts, the ancient texts and commentaries. They are valuable and an honorable path. And there is something else that is a special transmission outside of that. The thing itself, liberation itself, the truth of what the Buddha himself saw. Not just the way he and others that followed him thought about it and described it and even taught about it, but the thing itself. And this thing itself is a direct pointing to the human heart. This is what Zazen is. This is what our sitting is. This is what all of the chanting and bowing and teachings of Zen and practices and forms and bells and drums in Zen are a direct pointing for you to your human heart. Seeing, and all of this serves to allow us to see into our true nature. And this seeing into our true nature, resting in our true nature, entrusting us, ourselves, to the true nature that is not ours, does not belong to us, is not owned by us. This is the liberation that Buddhism offers. And so, Bodhidharma crossed the sea from west to east, which is to say from India to China. When he first arrived in China, he went to see the emperor. And the emperor had been a great supporter of the Buddhism that had been in China for a long time, and had built many monasteries, had sponsored many ordinations, brought in scholars to talk to him about Buddhism. And so he said to Bodhidharma, "So, you're a Buddhist monk from India, where they have all the magical stuff, as I understand it. So tell me, what merit have I gained from building all these monasteries, sponsoring all these ordinations?" Now, this is in keeping with one version of an understanding of interdependence and the functioning of karma. It is, in fact, a valuable thing to all beings to support the Dharma. And this was a traditional way that wealthy people in China and Japan supported the Dharma. And it is said that this builds merit. How do you understand merit? How do you understand this virtue? This is a great question, and something to be explored in perhaps another Dharma talk. But what it isn't is kind of like a credit on the cosmic account ledger of your goodness. This is what the emperor asked Bodhidharma: "How much merit have I gained from doing all this? Please tell me about my awesomeness. I'd really like to hear it." And Bodhidharma says, "No merit whatsoever. A staggering, bold statement said to one of the most powerful people in the world, the emperor of China." And the emperor is taken aback, and he says, who is this confronting me in this way?" And Bodhidharma, in another expression that has come to be utterly central to the Zen school, the emperor said to Bodhidharma, "Who is this person confronting me now?" And Bodhidharma says, "I don't know. I don't know." This "I don't know" is the vast humility of not knowing. This is the all-encompassing darkness, the endarkenment that is another name for enlightenment. This is not knowing. And when we recite the precepts, We say, not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, I vow to cease from evil. It is through not knowing which is the antidote to righteous certainty, also known as delusive certainty, also known as ignorance. Not knowing is what enables us to begin this practice of ceasing from causing harm, or beginning to cause less harm with our delusive certainty. We have a name for this one, ourself. My one is called Josh. His was called Bodhidharma. We have a name for it. But what is it? Are we sure that we understand it? Are we sure that it has a fixed, unchanging essence? Are we sure that just because it has a name and is useful for navigating the relative world, that it indeed exists the way we are conditioned and condition ourselves to believe it does? Bodhidharma says, I don't know. And then he goes off to carry on getting to the bottom of it himself, sitting facing a wall, sitting in the cave at Shaolin Monastery. Now, Bodhidharma, little side note here, is also alleged to be the founder of Kung Fu. I don't exactly know how that works, but it seems to be part of the legend. Nonetheless, he practiced at Shaolin Monastery, sitting in a cave by himself for years. 9 years, it's sometimes said. And at a certain point, a person approached him, one of my teachers used to describe it as Bodhidharma was sitting in the cave, kind of like with emitting the Dharma waves, the way a radio station tower emits radio waves. And some person became aware of him there. And came to Bodhidharma's cave in the middle of winter. And as was traditional in that culture, waited to be acknowledged before speaking. And Bodhidharma, as was traditional in his own practice of staring at the wall, did not acknowledge him. This person's name was Shen Kuang, stood before Bodhidharma's cave, beseeching him for instruction. The old barbarian, however, sat in zazen and paid no attention. One night there was a snowstorm, but Shen Kuang stood there unmoving, and the snow reached his knees. Finally, Bodhidharma said, you have been standing there a long time in the snow. What is it you want? Shen Kuang said, I beseech you, Master, open the gate of the Dharma and save all of us beings. Bodhidharma said, seemed to be quite harsh words, but said them generously from a place of love. Bodhidharma said, the incomparable truth of the Buddhas can only be attained by continual effort, practicing what cannot be practiced, bearing the unbearable. How can you, with your small virtue and wisdom, and your easygoing and conceited mind dare to aspire to the true teaching. And with this, it is said that Cheng Kuan drew a knife, cut off his hand, and presented it to Bodhidharma as a sign of his sincerity. Bodhidharma relented at last and accepted him as a disciple, giving him the name by which he is known today, Hui Ko, Light of Wisdom. And Hui Ko went on to become the second ancestor of Zen. Full disclosure, it seems that in the actual reality of history, the monk who became Hui Ko was a general in the Chinese army and had lost his hand in the war, but in a war, and this nonetheless got included as part of the legend. And then, so this was the beginning of Hui Ko's encounter with Bodhidharma, and he practiced with Bodhidharma for quite a long time. A large part of what that included was sitting with Bodhidharma together, facing a wall, facing the cave, facing the universe, facing the one bright pearl that is us and the universe together. This is what facing a wall is. And so he says to Bodhidharma, "Your disciple's mind is still not at peace. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind and I will put it to rest." And the second ancestor says, "I have searched for my mind exhaustively. I have searched heart and soul, but I cannot find it." Now let us not undervalue the importance of this exhaustively, really investigating. What is this thing that calls itself the self? What is this thing that I am sure is me? How do I understand self and mind? How do I understand this vast category that includes all mental formations, sensations, perceptions, discriminations, awareness, consciousness itself, ideas, stories, graspings, aversions? All of these are mental formations, intending, striving, trying, all mental formations. So what is the self? Who am I? What is this thing that I am so sure is not okay, that I'm so sure is fundamentally broken, that I'm so sure stands apart from the rest of the universe? I have searched for this exhaustively, and I can't find it. So really, this is part of our practice. This becomes, this searching exhaustively, this is koan introspection, this is analytical meditation, this is great doubt and deep questioning. This searching exhaustively can include such tools as philosophy, dharma study, psychotherapy. Art practices, all of these things can be tools of great doubt, the other side of which is great faith, these two together. Searching exhaustively really trying to get to the bottom of this question of who am I? My first teacher used to say that this question of who am I, this is the question that is the fundamental question that all people who come to Zen have. And every time he would say that, I would be thinking, am I in the wrong place? That wasn't my question. My question was related. My question is, why does it hurt so much to be me? Why is it so much harder for me to be me than those ducks to be those ducks? That was my question. That was the form it took for me. What's the form it takes for you? And really investigate that exhaustively. And he says, but I cannot find it. And Bodhidharma says, there, I have put it to rest for you. And this relates to a couple of the pieces we read today. One from Master Linji. Chinese Zen teacher who came a few centuries after Bodhidharma. Linji says, there is no Buddha, no Dharma, no practice, no realization. What is it you seek in others? What is it you lack? Rather than seeking, it would be better to hear these words, rest and practice. Having nothing to do. Practice having nothing to do. This is a practice that we take up. It is a practice we do. This practice that cannot be done, this practice of having nothing to do, this is different than, just fuck it. Practice having nothing to do. If something has arisen, Linji says, don't try to make it continue. If something has not arisen, don't try to make it arise. The other piece we read, Bearing the Unbearable, from Bearing the Unbearable, which is a book by a contemporary clinical psychologist, who's a Zen priest, who specializes in working with grief. This is a book I recommend to all of you. It is called, the subtitle is Love, Loss, and the Heartbreaking Path of Grief. And her name is Joanne Cacciatore. She talks about living into reality, living into the grief that is part of the function of loving itself means that whatever we feel moment to my moment, accepting it, gradually coming to experience what it truly is. Whatever comes, we let be as it is. She says, this is grief's most piercing message. There is no way around. The only way is through. The only way is in. The only way is here. And just this. This is the context, the place in which we practice having nothing to do. And Master, the compiler of this collection, Master Mumon, added a verse praising Bodhidharma, coming from the West and directly pointing, all the troubles spring from this. The jungle of monks in all these Zen monasteries is your fault after all. Thank you, everyone. Please sit comfortably. And be invited into our practice of Dharma dialogue. Questions? comments, resonances with the koans, with Bodhidharma, with anything that we read as part of tonight's service, searching for your own mind exhaustively, whatever form it takes. And what does it mean to be fully exhausted? Yeah. It's exhausting work being human.
In for me with the sable beings, just as you said multiple times, such a big ask that you're gonna fail. And so there's some way in which that's freeing. And so I kind of wanted to ask, well, I search exhaustively. Why not be like, well, I'm not gonna do this, right? I'm not going to succeed. So why not just kind of like take it on faith? That I'm not
going to
get there, and then well, I might be less exhausted.
What is get there?
Finish exhausted.
Mm-hmm. So that is a path too. In a certain way. That is a, so searching exhaustively is a mode of great doubt. And that is one way, one thing that can be the main form of practice. Another thing that can be the main form of practice is great faith. And so you say, just take it on faith. And it's true. That is, in fact, that would be practicing it. But really do that. Really live into this, to the thing you're taking on faith, the inseparability of self from universe. And live and sit as an expression of that faith. Save all beings as an expression of that faith. You really practice that faith, that too is a all-inclusive practice. But don't go up the middle of, oh, whatever, it's probably true, I can't really be bothered, but I'm just going to go on doing this. Like, I mean, that's fine, you can do that. That isn't the path to liberation.
I think it's good that there are two paths, because this being cannot depend on faith. It's like, what? That makes no sense.
Right.
That's my personal reaction. And there are other people who seem to work for them. Confuses me, but great for them.
Right.
I'm more of a doubt person where I have to, if I don't investigate it thoroughly.
Yeah, and one way that I describe the Zen path is it is a path of progressively verified faith. And doubting is the process of personally and progressively verifying it. But it does take, and even you enact a certain amount of faith by coming back a second time for a second period of Zazen. There is a And the reason that you do that, even though you haven't necessarily personally verified all of what all of these Buddhist teachers are saying, it is because something about it actually does feel true, does feel like coming home,
yeah.
And does make sense, even if you can't understand why it makes sense. And then the rest of practice is kind of bringing the rest of your mind into alignment with that thing that recognizes, oh, there is something to come home to here.
Like not like personal deficit, but some like something inherent in reality missing here.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? It feels like it's missing. And I feel like maybe I've gone down the exhaustive road because it feels like I never got an answer to that initial question, but it feels like there's this dissipation effect.
Yeah. Nicely expressed. And that reminds me we hold on for as long as we need to hold on. And that's the exhaustive. And then what I hear you describing is a kind of opening the hand of thought around that. And this lack. This sense of lack, this feeling of lack. It's said that there are three dharma seals, three marks that all phenomena in the universe bear. One of them is impermanence, continual change. The other one is essencelessness, no fixed, unchanging essence. And the third one is unsatisfactoriness. Which means that there is no phenomena, no experience, no thing that you can ever get and have and hold that is lastingly satisfactory. And so we learn to practice amid this unsatisfactoriness, and we find an enoughness that isn't in opposition to it, but inclusive of it. Thank you, Zach. And I appreciate that word dissipation. That's also a good way of pointing to some of the fruits of practice. It isn't that you get enlightenment and then have this new and great thing. It's that the certainty of lack is a problem starts to dissipate sometimes. And then comes back. Right.
Because chasing, the thing will just go faster and further away.
Right. Yeah.
So for me, I also have this thing that is all the time for myself and other people, which is let go or be dragged. So if I'm feeling like I'm really caught up in something and it's distracting me or then I just have to let go of it. Nothing I don't care about it. I might really care about it, but then just realizing that it's having some kind of power over my ability to just experience the world. So the letting go, it's a release. It's not a casting off, but it's stopping the chasing. being okay to explore, work towards something, something about goals, as long as they're not.
And part of when goals become just the grasping after or running after is when we have a story that if only I were over there, once I have that, then I'll be okay. Once, if only, or whereas goals or maybe valued action, which is part of what Zen points us to, is taking alignment in accordance with our values, unattached to outcome, not dependent on it going some way or not some other way, but acting anyhow in alignment with our values. And I love this image of chasing versus just putting one foot in front of the other and exploring. And in some ways, that's what we're actualizing with walking meditation. We're walking meditation, we walk in a circle around where are we going. We don't get anywhere. But the practice of walking is itself valuable and powerful. And you're also kind of pointing to the appreciating the journey and exploring in the journey. Without making it fixed on destination. Thank you. And let go or be dragged is great. And sometimes the thing is that being dragged is an option that we can take sometimes. Holding on when we can't let go, holding on is included too.
Noticing for myself recently is in regard to like sort of self-discipline, which is something I have a lot of challenges with. Noticing, and I think this is sort of rooted in my practice, noticing that if I approach it from a place of like inquisitiveness instead of like a directive or a goal, it really opens up what that looks like. Like, you know, if it's just like this sort of like a habit energy thing, like, oh, like I'm just gonna check myself out now for literally no reason. Instead of being like, don't do that, I think like, well, what would happen if I didn't? And then it's like, well, sometimes, usually, the answer is like, oh, I guess like really nothing would happen. Like, I'll do something else. Great. But then other times it is like, oh, well, I like, you know, I think I'll just, for whatever reason, like be really stressed out if I don't do this. So I'll just do it. And like having sort of like approaching it from that angle feels so different.
And you know one way that kind of can get distilled down is the practice of what's here now in this impulse to do this thing, what's here now in this visceral arising of anxiety, what's here now as I'm having these stories, and what happens if I meet just this rather than doing the thing that my mind is screaming I have to do. And this is the value of practicing stillness in Zazen. So each time, we don't sit still for the machismo of look how good we are at sitting still. It's because we are actually practicing freeing ourselves from the shackles of our own mind. Our own mind screams, you have to move. You'll totally explode if you don't move right now. And then in our normal life, we move or we shift or we fix something or we scratch an itch. But when we don't do that in Zazen, we are starting to see that this thing that feels like a truth, you have to move or you'll explode and die, isn't that thing. And we are starting to see this is called the emptiness of mental formations. And this is the beginning of being able to be choicefully and flexibly present in our lives and able to act in alignment with our values more consistently rather than just getting yanked around by our own conditioned grasping and aversion.
Is that sort of where the, like, slowly verified faith comes in? Because that really resonates with me, that, like, yeah, like, I literally proved to myself that I don't have to do the thing that automatically want to do. It's like, wow, that is real.
Right. And if I were just saying, you don't have to do that thing. No, I really do. I can tell from looking at my mind that I really do. And then, but by practicing Zazen, you start to see for yourself, actually, I don't. And so even if you don't have a great intellectual handle on what it means to say the emptiness of mental formation, you're seeing that actually I don't have to do everything my mind screams at me. One last comment, Ilya.
Sure. Thanks for that. I think taking it on faith to practice in a counterintuitive way, this practice of Shigantaza, of actually kind of letting things come to me, and in one sense it kind of sounds passive, but in the process it feels very much like a thorough and active investigation, because as soon as I decide to sit still and let things come to me, there is so much more that comes to me than I think I could have sought out by, like, trying to find it and journal and reason my way to what's the problem. You know, in these 25 minutes, it feels like 3 hours with, like, the amount of things that I'm thinking about and processing and seeing. So it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, and you're kind of in the vicinity of what I call the metabolizing function of Zazen. Like doing Zazen allows this stuff to gradually get metabolized, and it isn't the thing you have to do. Just as you don't have to, like, do your liver metabolizing whatever, you know. Okay, do it. But it's a thing that by allowing the space for it, it happens. And that is a verifiable fruit of Zazen too. Thank you, everybody.